from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Wright of ABC News, and this is On Point. The war on coal is a phrase that entered our political lexicon about a decade ago. At the very end of the 2008 campaign, Republicans started calling attention to an interview that then-Senator Barack Obama gave to the San Francisco Chronicle when he was campaigning for president.
If somebody wants to build a coal-powered plant, they can. It's just that it will bankrupt them because they're going to be charged a huge sum for all that greenhouse gas that's being emitted.
The war on coal, that phrase, came into the lexicon then. Many people in coal country felt under attack, insisting that the Democrats cared more about the environment than they do about their jobs. And when President Trump came along, he promised to bring coal jobs back. Our guest this hour, Kelly McEvers, has spent more than a year following up in coal country. You can hear her reporting on the NPR podcast Embedded. This hour on Point, Embedded in Coal Country. Where do you come down in the debate over coal versus climate change? Are you from coal country or the Rust Belt? Are jobs making a comeback in your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. Later this hour, we'll be talking about President Trump's changing stance on China and ZTE. But first, joining me now from NPR West in Culver City is Kelly McEvers, host of the NPR podcast Embedded. Kelly, welcome back to On Point.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
This is such an interesting podcast, and it must be such an interesting reporting assignment. I gather you've been back there just a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
What is the mood in coal country these days?
You know, it depends on who you ask, right? There are people who have a connection to coal, who maybe their fathers and grandfathers worked in coal, and who really want to believe that it's possible that there could be a comeback. And there are also the same people who are seeing some mines reopen and some jobs coming back. And that excites them. We met a guy who, you know, has wanted to be a coal miner his whole life, a young guy in his 20s, spent months and months and months driving around in his truck, just applying for jobs, finally got the job. It's like a dream come true for him. You know, for him, being able to stay at home and work a well-paying job where you make $20, $25, eventually $30 an hour, that to him's the American dream, you know? And so that's one side of it, right? And there's a lot of other people who say, look, the writing's on the wall. It's been on the wall for a long time. A president can't save an industry. The world is changing in a lot of ways. You know, the kind of coal that we paid attention to is metallurgical coal, where the counties where we spent the most time in central Appalachia. That's the kind of coal that makes steel. The United States, you know, doesn't, you know,
the steel industry ain't what it was.
Exactly, right? And so a lot of that coal is being exported anyway. So there's been a little comeback in that kind of coal. Thermal coal, the kind that makes electricity. Everyone knows that natural gas is rapidly replacing that kind of coal. And they think it's time to talk about a post-coal Central Appalachia. Who are we and how can we move forward without this industry?
Interesting.
So, yeah, depends on who you ask.
I mean, you hear this phrase down in West Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, throughout that region. They talk about the Trump effect.
Mm-hmm.
And does President Trump deserve the credit for what improvements there have been?
Okay, so this is something we looked at really closely, right? We started going to these counties in, say, again, Southwest Virginia and Eastern Kentucky mainly is where we spent time. And right after the election, we started to see there was this thing happening. There were more jobs and a few mines opening up in the metallurgical coal industry. Again, this is the kind that makes steel. And
we have a section of the podcast teed up, so maybe we should play it and then talk out of it. What do you think? Let's give a listen.
As for why this is happening, some people say it all started when Trump got elected.
It was like overnight. Everything just started to rise, you know, the coal price went up.
I've never seen as many coal trucks as I have, just driving around as he's got elected, you know.
Without Trump, we wouldn't gonna have a job.
Actually, the day that he was inaugurated on, I started back to work, so.
But like we said, it is not just about Trump. And some people talk about that too, like Joe Street.
Joe owns a company that makes conveyor belts for mines. It's in Buchanan County, Virginia. And in early 2017, we go to see him. And while he's eating breakfast, he tells us how great business has been.
Right now, we are backed up in orders.
So I ask him, when did things start getting better? And then he says something that surprises me.
Since when?
Probably September.
September 2016. I ask him twice, just to make sure I heard him right. Because September 2016, of course, is before Trump won the election. And he says, yeah, September.
That's a selection of episode one of this season of Embedded. Back live now with Kelly McEvers. So the timetable doesn't quite match up, does it?
Right. So when we started going, you know, it's just we actually started going right before the election. But then, yeah, we saw this bump after the election. And then we started talking to people and they're like, actually, in early 2016, something happened in China that affected the metallurgical coal market in the United States. And that was China decided, for a bunch of different reasons, that its coal mines should operate fewer days per year. You can do this in China, right? You can say to an entire industry, like, instead of mining coal for 330 days a year or whatever, you have to mine only for 276 days a year. They can control supply and demand in that way. So when that happened, supply goes down, right? And demand stays the same. So the price of metallurgical coal went up. And these mines in this area of central Appalachia, you know, started to benefit from that because they mine metallurgical coal. And then right after the election, there was a cyclone in Australia. A lot of the coal mines were flooded.
Ah.
And so a lot of the coal mines in Australia, one of the biggest producers of metallurgical coal in the world, shut down. So again, supply goes down, price goes up. So that is one of the biggest reasons we're seeing this bump in metallurgical coal. And people, you know, in the region who work in the business know this, but they also say, you know, add to that, there is a confidence in Trump. And we talked to analysts and economists about this, and they said, that's part of it, too. There is a confidence in the election of Donald Trump that you've got. If you're an energy company and you're looking at your portfolio, you're thinking, should I reopen this mine or not? The prices look good thanks to Australia and China. But I also have this president who's, you know, I know is willing to go to bat for me. That's maybe going to push you over the edge and help you make a decision to invest. So it's kind of this combination of all of these things. But what do people on the ground, you know,
yeah. I mean, but
regular people, they just want to believe it's the politicians.
Sure. But there's something to that. We call it the audacity of hope.
Maybe. you could reclaim that phrase, sure.
That's right. I mean, but these are, you know, I always hear the president talking about clean coal. What exactly is that?
Well, and now that's in the territory of thermal coal, right? And he's talking about the kind of coal that you burn to make electricity. And that is not something we really looked into because we were focusing, again, on these counties in central Appalachia that mine metallurgical coal.
But this is a time where coal-fired power plants, which is a predominant use of coal, I think, these days, are being shut down, not only in this country but around the world.
That's right.
So there is less of a demand, and that ultimately is what is the cloud hanging over this region, right?
That's right. Yeah, and then you raised it, you know, in the introduction really well. You know, there's the question, I think, that's still in the region is whose fault is that, right? And again, everyone likes to point fingers at politicians. It was Obama who killed coal. And, you know, Hillary Clinton during her campaign for president, you know, there's this moment that everybody remembers. I mean, she herself considers it one of the big mistakes of her campaign. She spent an entire chapter of her book on it. Her book about the campaign was this moment when she's doing a town hall in Ohio and she's talking about sort of a post-coal future. And she says, because we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of business, right? And it's in the context of this bigger, you know, explanation of what she wants to do to help sort of the region transition. But what does everybody hear? They hear that one line and it gets played over and over and over again. And so when, you know, you're looking at this, whether it's thermal coal and you're looking at natural gas replacing thermal coal or metallurgical coal and the sort of the Chinese and the Australians, all of that gets lost. And all it becomes is the Democrats hated coal and they wanted to kill coal and the Republicans and President Trump want to bring it back. And it's just more complicated than that.
We have that section of the podcast queued up right now. So let's listen to it.
A lot of people are blaming Obama and the Democrats and the so-called war on coal. And then this happens.
Look.
At a CNN town hall in Ohio, Hillary Clinton gets asked, what do you have to offer to poor white voters? And her answer, it comes to be known as one of the biggest mistakes of her campaign. She later writes an entire chapter about it in her book about the election.
So, for example, I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country. Because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Right, Tim?
She's talking to Congressman Tim Ryan, who's a Democrat from Ohio. And she's just said, we're going to put coal miners out of business. But then she goes on to talk about how she actually wants to help people in coal country.
And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people. Those people labored in those mines for generations, losing their health, often losing their lives, to turn on our lights and power our factories. Now we've got to move away from coal. But I don't want to move away from the people who did the best they could to produce the energy that we relied on.
So she's saying all this, but what's the only thing that people hear?
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business.
A few months later, Donald Trump comes to coal country.
Thank you very much.
And gets a big endorsement from the industry in West Virginia.
See, I come here, I get an award. It's probably a hard hat. So let's see if it's a hard hat. It's a hard hat. Y'all put it on, right?
He pretends he's shoveling. The crowd loves it.
And for those miners, get ready because you're going to be working your asses off, all right? Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
Donald Trump suddenly becomes the guy who's going to end this war on coal.
That's a selection of the NPR podcast Embedded. You can join the conversation. How do you relate to these stories from coal country? What do you make of the Trump administration's effort to bring back jobs? I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you love to find and hear great new music, but you don't know where to start, let All Songs Considered be your guide. It's NPR's weekly music discussion and discovery podcast with tons of new songs and artists to fall in love with. Hear All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. We're talking with Kelly McEvers about the new season of her podcast, Embedded. And the voice you've also been hearing there is her producer, Chris Benderev, talking about the experience of life in coal country, whether we can bring jobs back there, as the President Trump is trying to do, and how realistic that is. I'd also like to bring another voice into the conversation. And joining us now from Somerset, Kentucky, is Bill Estep. He is a reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader, covering southern and eastern Kentucky, also coal country. Bill, welcome.
Hi, David.
Hi there. You live and have lived for years in this region where this debate, while it is front and center these days, has been going on for some time, hasn't it?
It has been. I mean, the coal industry in eastern Kentucky, really central Appalachia generally, has really taken a nosedive since about 2011, 2012. The number of jobs in eastern Kentucky has dropped off by about 70% since 2011. So there have been people grappling with the issue of how to deal with that for a long time now. But in a larger sense, the coal industry has been losing jobs in eastern Kentucky really since the peak of about 1990. So the folks have been looking at this for a long time.
This is also a region that has struggled with generational poverty. Politicians have tried and failed for years to intervene and improve things for people going way back, right?
It has been, sure. Really, dating back to the 60s was really a low point. A lot of folks left the area then because there were no jobs. The war on poverty that was started in the 60s really made an impact in the area. Poverty rates in some of the counties dropped by half, but even with that improvement, the poverty rates, of course, are relative to the national rate, and they're still 2 and 3 times the national rate in some of the counties out in eastern
sure.
Kentucky. And the reason coal was so important in that mix is because in a lot of counties, those were the only private sector jobs that paid well in a lot of the counties in eastern Kentucky.
There's that very famous book, Night Comes to the Cumberlands, which looks at poverty in eastern Kentucky, really. Bobby Kennedy made some trips there, as you mentioned. The War on Poverty really took aim at trying to help folks there. And yet, a generation or so later, what had been a Democratic stronghold is now a Republican stronghold. Can you explain that to me?
Part of it is because of social issues. Eastern Kentucky is culturally, religiously conservative area, so generally more opposition to abortion, for instance, than in some other places. More opposition to same-sex marriage, some of those cultural issues. More support for gun rights, Second Amendment rights. So a lot of people in eastern Kentucky who were traditionally Democrats because of economic issues going back to the 30s, you know, when the United Mine Workers were very strong in eastern Kentucky, a lot of people switched over to Democrat to support the United Mine Workers coming out of the 30s and the 40s. That really started to switch back because of some of the social issues. A lot of Democrats in eastern Kentucky felt like that the Democratic Party left them, you know, moved to the left and got involved in some of the social issues, and they had a more conservative view on those issues.
Interesting. Kelly McEvers, how does that square with your experience?
You know, I mean, we, again, focus mostly on the jobs and coal and how people feel about coal and not as much on the social issues. But one thing we saw, too, was, you know, it's interesting Bill brings up the union because, you know, as the union declined, you know, back when the union was strong, you know, the sort of the general positioning was it was the people against the companies, right? I mean, you had some of the most sort of well-known strikes there in Harlan County, Kentucky, right? Harlan County, USA, one of the greatest documentaries from that time in
sure.
the 70s.
And some hard-fought gains, protecting people's safety,
absolutely.
Providing health care, a pension.
That's right, right. I mean, like fighting for real things,
right.
for real people.
Do the new jobs
protections.
That are coming there have those kinds of protections?
They do in some places. I mean, it depends on where you are. But I think what happened is as the union declined and the industry, they really worked to sort of change the narrative. You know, it's not the people versus the companies. It's we companies standing with you. They call it Friends of Coal. I mean, it's a membership organization called Friends of Coal, and it's the industry, right, who runs this organization. And the idea was to get the people, you know, we're on your side. We're the ones providing jobs. It's the government that's taking away your jobs. It's the government who's bad. It's the environmentalists who are bad.
Hence the candidacy of Don Blankenship.
And that really, you know, that really shifted things. Don Blankenship, of course, yeah, you know, former coal baron from West Virginia, you know, failed run for the U.S. Senate in West Virginia recently.
Bill Estep, I've made some reporting trips down to Whitesburg, Kentucky, to talk with Trump voters there. We met one couple in particular who we've been back to several times who face an odd situation. They voted, he's a former coal truck driver, voted for Donald Trump, now suffers from black lung disease. He's out of a job and he depends on Obamacare. So he was at a very tricky moment about a year ago when they were trying to basically do away with Obamacare. And yet he did not regret for one minute his vote for Donald Trump. Is that your experience talking to folks as well? That people are willing to give
a lot of folks.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we were just elected along the narrative of why would a place where
I think we might need you to find a better cell service location. We'll try to dial you back. In the meantime, I'll toss that question over to Kelly McEvers. Is there any doubt in people's minds there, or is it simply, they're going with the guy who's coming back again and again, promising to deal with them?
You know, yeah. I mean, again, people seeing, in front of their faces, right? There's more coal trucks on the road. There's more coal in the trains. You know, this kid we talked to, who I talked about, I shouldn't call him a kid, this guy in his early 20s, you know, who wanted to be a coal miner his whole life and got a job, you know, he realized that something was happening one day. He was driving around his truck and he heard an ad for a job in coal. And that had just had not been something that was he even thought possible for years and years. Jobs took a real dip. In 2016. And here he is hearing like, do you want a job in coal and a radio ad? And he's thinking, wow. And so, you know, people, those kinds of things, people are saying, look, you know, this guy is doing what he promised he would do. Again, we know it's more complicated than that. We know it's a lot more complicated than that. But what matters is how people feel. You know, it's one thing to talk about this industry being in decline with, you know, experts and economists and stuff at universities. It's another thing to live it. You know, whatever side you're on, this is a place where, again, as Bill said, coal jobs were the one way you could really make a good living. And it was something to aspire to, and to watch those jobs sort of disappear. I mean, that was something we just sort of wanted to feel. And it doesn't feel good. You know, it doesn't feel good, as this woman told us at one point, you know, that on Fridays you're packing lunches for the kids to take home for the weekend just because, you know, there might not be enough food at home, right? That doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good when your husband is working harder than he did before for a lot less money, fewer benefits, and the like. Now, again, whose fault is that? Is that the politician's fault? Is that the company's fault? I think that's more complicated. But what we know is it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, for sure. Danny is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Danny, what's your thought?
Hi, David. I'm from West Virginia. And let me just say this. Why don't we step back from the coal baron, his daddy, and he provides jobs for these people, and the people should be real grateful for that. Because if you go back 300 years in West Virginia, families that moved there centuries ago used to own hundreds and thousands of acres that had all of this mineral rights for this coal. And systematically, the coal companies took those rights away from them through the legislature and whatnot. And so unless you redress for West Virginia, which has always had this problem, it's not, you can't just set up straw men and blame the coal company barons and the politicians. It's about how the wealth was extracted from the people who own the land in West Virginia. Yeah. And until that's addressed, until you go back and you look at how much wealth was lost by families that owned that land originally, did not share in that, that money would have been reinvested in West Virginia in other ways than coal.
And coal, is worth noting also, is pretty hard on the landscape. It not only kind of ravages those hillsides, but also ravages people's health in many cases.
I get emotional because I'm from there, and they've shaved off the top of the mountains because that's the cheapest way to take it out now. Yeah. The investors are all hot money hedge fund guys from somewhere else. Yeah. And if they can get a quick return, so be it. And that's what you're facing in West Virginia. And that's why it's so hard to change, because it's just really the people who now own all of the rights of all the minerals in West Virginia underneath the land that control how this gets talked about.
Thanks so much for the call,
Danny.
Really appreciate it.
People, if you don't own the thing, you don't have agency, right? And that's been true for so long. I mean, this is something that was brought up in that book, Night Comes to the Cumberlands, right? That famous book you mentioned that was written in the 60s. I mean, it's an extractive industry, right? Billions of dollars being taken out of a mountain and sent somewhere else. Yes, they are good jobs when you have them and when times are good. You know, you've got money to put food on the table and buy a car, but is it good for the region? And, you know, with other extractive industries, oil, anything else, it's rarely good for everyone, right? I talked to a guy just this past weekend, and I said, you know, hey, you made a lot of money when you worked in coal. He said, I made a lot of money for U.S. Steel.
Wow. Heartbreaking. Listen, Kelly, tell us what we have to look forward to. I've listened to the podcast and I'm pretty up to date on it and I'm intrigued at what might be coming next.
Yeah, we spent some time in Harlan County, Kentucky. We're going to talk about African-American coal miners. As one woman put it who studies this region, it's the great migration story you've never heard. Early 1900s, recruiters going down to Alabama, getting African-American men who were working as sharecroppers, bringing them up to Kentucky, setting them up in coal camps, right? These are, you know, back then they were, it was the company town, the company owned the house, the company owned the store. You got paid in scrip. You didn't get paid in actual money. And a really interesting history and legacy of African-American coal miners, starting back again, you know, early 1900s, there are very few African-American coal miners now. There are a lot of old timers around who will tell you a lot of the stories. And for us, that sort of raises the question of whose jobs are these anyway, right? You know, this image right now of the coal miner and bringing the jobs back and sort of the people who deserve this job, that's an image of a white coal miner, right? And we, you know, what we want to do in this next episode is sort of complicate that a little bit and talk to some of the people who have other experiences. A lot of immigrants came to this area to work in coal as well. So
look forward to that.
Yeah.
Bill Estep, before we let you go, I know that there is some sensitivity to folks as much as it's important to hear from folks on the ground in this region. There is some sensitivity to outsiders coming from New York or Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. or wherever, spending a couple of days and heading back. And I wonder, are we getting the story right? What are we missing?
I think the sensitivity is that some of the stories, nobody likes to be portrayed in a negative light. And frankly, a lot of the stories about Eastern Kentucky have been justifiably negative. I mean, about the poverty and about the drug abuse and about the loss of jobs. What people in the region feel like sometimes is that, you know, they love their home. There are good people who live there who are trying to do the best they can. And they feel like that sort of positive side doesn't get reflected very well. But the fact is, I mean, there are enormous challenges facing Eastern Kentucky. There are some promising ideas about some jobs coming in to replace the coal industry jobs, but there is nothing yet. People on the ground here, you know, some of the developers talk about silver BBs. It's going to take 20 things to replace that one thing, the coal industry mm-hmm. that used to dominate there. So mm-hmm. there is nothing yet that has come in that will replace those 70% of coal jobs that have been lost over the last 5 or 6 years.
Kelly, have you had a warm reception there?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
They don't say NPR?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, we started going before the presidential election, and we've been going for a year and a half. Started mostly in Buchanan County, Virginia, and sort of have branched out into a couple more counties in Virginia and then over the mountains in eastern Kentucky. And no, I mean, everyone I've met has just been so unbelievably friendly. It's incredible. People, you know, like I said, they feel really strongly about this one way or the other. And if you're just saying, I'm here to listen, you know, people want to talk. We are acutely aware, I must say, of the dangerous, like, project of being an outsider coming in.
I mean, poverty tourism.
This has not been done well for a really, really long time. And we did our homework. We spend a lot of time thinking about it. That's not going to change the facts that we are actually outsiders coming in. But, you know, I think the best thing to do is instead of going in with the hypothesis, you know, I think a lot of the sort of Trump country coverage is like, let's go, you know, meet the guy who's, you know, lives next to the gas station in the wooden shack and sort of, you know, just do like the quick stereotype story.
Sure.
We just went in saying, we don't know what we're going to find. We're really interested in you. We're just here to listen.
If I could add, just real briefly.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I've covered Eastern Kentucky for more than 30 years. The people there are very welcoming. But they want to know that you're going to spend the time to try to get it right.
Absolutely. That's a completely fair point on their part. But I'm aware of this debate. And also J.D. Vance writes about his revulsion of people with what he calls TV accents.
Sure.
Well, yeah, and but he, you know, he's controversial too. Yeah. I don't think people feel like he represents them very well either. A lot of people I talk to, at least. So,
no,
yeah.
A lot of people in Kentucky feel like that book didn't get it right.
That's right. Who very gets to claim the story? It's a very, very interesting thing. I certainly don't. So.
Well, it's a fascinating podcast and a very tricky issue and one that we'll continue to develop. NPR's Kelly McEvers, host of the podcast Embedded. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Bill Estep, reporter for the Lexington Herald-Leader. Thanks you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're going to be discussing Chinese jobs, the Chinese telecommunications company ZTE, and how it became the focus of U.S.-China relations. You can join the conversation. Should President Trump help save ZTE? I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and ponderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Wright. President Trump campaigned on the promise to bring back American jobs. He also took a pretty tough line on China, among other countries. But this weekend, the president tweeted, out of the blue it would seem, about jobs that need saving in China. The president has ordered a review of U.S. sanctions against Chinese telecom ZTE, which had been implicated in cyber espionage activities. Trump's about-face comes as the U.S. is engaged in trade talks with China and on the eve of the possible summit with North Korea, where, of course, China's leverage might be important. What do you make of the president's sudden concern about the welfare of this Chinese company? Is it canny politics or just a flip-flop? Joining me now from Washington is Bob Davis. He's senior editor at The Wall Street Journal. You can link to his latest story on this issue at our website, onpointradio.org. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Thanks very much.
Also joining me from Washington is Derek Scissors, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on the Chinese economy. Welcome to you.
Thanks.
First to you, Bob Davis, what do we know about why the president suddenly is concerned about this company?
Well, I think the president wants to deal with China, and China, one of their top priorities is dealing with ZTE and making sure that U.S. sanctions don't wind up as a death sentence for the company. He had a long conversation with Chinese leader Xi Jinping before he came out with that, shall we say, surprising tweet. The Treasury Secretary also is pushing in that direction, and I think he wants to clear the decks before the summit with North Korea, assuming that's still on.
Tell us a bit more about this company. What is the concern, and why has it been red flagged?
Well, I mean, in 2017, they were fined $1.2 billion for exporting U.S. technology to Iran and North Korea. It was the biggest fine the Commerce Department has ever levied. So that was a big deal. And then Commerce looked at them again. And then ZTE made a number of promises, essentially to clean house, not to do it again. And Commerce found that they hadn't gone through with their promises, and the punishment then was 7 years that you couldn't use U.S.-made parts, and U.S.-made parts are crucial to ZTE products, which are cell phones and communications device. So essentially, that probably would kill the company. Now, even before Trump got involved, ZTE appealed again to Commerce. They were thinking about it. It's very unusual for a government agency to actually impose a sanction that would put a company out of business. Yeah.
Yeah. Still, the decision to go easy on the sanctions is not going over well in Washington. Here's Senator Marco Rubio on the floor of the Senate on Tuesday.
I think it'd be deeply problematic for the national security of the United States and ultimately for his hopes of rebalancing America's relationship with China geopolitically, economically, commercially, and certainly on security.
Among the others expressing concern, President Trump's FBI director, Christopher Wray. He spoke with the Senate just yesterday, actually.
We, the FBI, remain deeply concerned than any company beholden to foreign governments that don't share our values, are not companies that we want to be gaining positions of power inside our telecommunications network. That gives them the capacity to maliciously modify or steal information. That gives them the capacity to conduct undetected espionage. That gives them the capacity to exert pressure or control.
Derek Scissors from the American Enterprise Institute, where should the politics be at this point? It seems like Washington is a city divided, even among the Republicans.
Well, I think it's President Trump and Secretary Mnuchin on one side and everybody else on the other. You know, what the FBI director just said is consensus view, which is we don't want Chinese telecommunications companies operating in the United States to any significant extent. President Trump was criticized by Senator Rubio, Senator Schumer, many other people for his Sunday tweet. I think you'll see that language about jobs lost in China used against him in 2020. If there's a controversy, it's over whether ZTE should be part of a deal, whether we can get, as the president implied yesterday on Twitter, we can get a great deal or a really a much better deal than we've gotten with China if we include everything like ZTE. And even there, I think the president's wrong, although it's a much tougher call. The Commerce Department was a finding of law. It wasn't a matter of U.S. policy decisions like tariffs or Chinese policy decisions like holding up U.S. agricultural exports. We can't undermine American law for the sake of a deal with China that the Chinese, you know, very possibly won't end up keeping. So, you know, ZTE should not have a role in the American telecommunications system. That's obvious. We shouldn't care about saving jobs in China. That's obvious. The tougher one is whether ZTE should be part of a deal. And even there, I think the president is wrong, that you don't undermine American law for the sake of reducing the trade deficit or anything else in a deal with China.
Let's hear from Roland calling from Nashville.
Hey, David. An aspect of this that I feel that we keep glossing over is ZTE being the largest producers of cell phones in the world, from what I understand, they rely heavily on American-made parts. So it's not, you know, maybe just Trump had a deal what he typically does and kind of bad on the communication of it, but it really is, it's helping American jobs and Chinese jobs. It's a win-win, in my estimation.
Derek Scissors, assuming that's true, is that a justification for relieving the sanctions and keeping that company afloat?
I don't think so. I understand. The caller is absolutely right. There are American jobs at stake, and there's a cost to the United States of cutting ZTE off. There's a bigger cost to China, but there is a cost to the United States. But if ZTE is guilty of breaking sanctions on Iran and North Korea and then not doing what it told the U.S. government was supposed to do, our law comes first. And, you know, and the oddest thing about this is the president just canceled the Iran deal, which means sanctions against Iran are more important. And yet we seem to be sending a signal that, oh, yeah, you know, if you're a big enough company that's important enough in the world, as the caller correctly said, you don't really have to follow those sanctions. So there is an economic cost to the United States. Caller is right. I don't think it's worth undermining American law.
Aurora is calling from Rockland, Maine. Hi, Aurora.
Hi, David. You know, in the way that I look at it is this is pretty quintessential Trump. You know, he, on the campaign trail, went there and said XYZ that he was going to go against all of these different things. And then throughout this entire past year, he's done almost the exact opposite on all of those things that he promised on his campaign trail. And so the way that this looks like is just he's trying to get the best deal for him and for the best deal for not the United States. You know, he wants China to look at him favorably because, you know, probably in the grand scheme of this, he's got some kind of business deal also included somewhere in this, because we can see throughout everything with his different family members and with his different, you know, real estate transactions and other deals that he's got his fingers in a lot of pots. And so
that might be a little bit, I mean, that's a kinder way of saying it. I mean, what you're saying is that he has a short attention span and a bunch of competing interests and he bounces back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah. Fair criticism, Derek Scissors?
I think it's a fair criticism. I think the fact that the president would ever tweet too many jobs lost in China shows that's not something that I think he's happy about. I think he wish he could take that back. So I think that does come out of maybe what Bob said about a call with Xi Jinping and talking to Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. and he just got caught up in that view and doesn't really mean it and then bounces back the other way. I just want to make one point. The president has been accused of benefiting from a Chinese loan in Indonesia. That's factually incorrect. The Chinese association with the Indonesia project. This is not by the caller, but by the media.
No, we have another caller who wants to get at that point. And why don't we hear from her, and then you can respond, okay?
Sure.
So Melissa from Youngstown, Ohio, talk to us.
Yes, hello. Well, I would actually be interested to hear what he has to say, your guest, because I had not heard that it was factually incorrect, but granted, I had not spent a lot of time researching the issue.
Sure.
But from the few articles that I had seen, it did seem like there was Chinese investment into one of the Trump businesses projects in Indonesia, and it seemed to, like many things, any kind of flattery or investment or quote-unquote donation always seems to sway Trump's opinion or behavior into favor of that particular person, regardless of what he has said in the past.
Sure, so this is a much more cynical view of an ulterior motive than whether he's trying to curry favor with China for helping the trade talks or the North Koreans. This is an accusation leveled in some publications that Trump branded properties in Indonesia stand to benefit from an investment from a Chinese state-run bank. True or not true, Derek Scissors?
Look, the president and his family have a lot of business dealings with China, and if you want to say, I think that affects his view, I think that that could be true. We don't know that. But the Indonesia deal in particular, this company was tied up with the Chinese in 2015. They announced this project in 2016. They hired a Chinese company to build it. That hiring, if the project go forward, came with the Chinese loan. All this occurred before the president wins the election. As we remember, he wasn't supposed to win the election, and the project still hasn't gone forward, and the loan still hasn't happened. So this would be a very strange deal to change the president's mind. He has a lot of contacts with China that hasn't prevented him from using inflammatory language and threatening tariffs. This one is really minor.
Interesting. Bob Davis, have you done any reporting on that aspect of it?
No, honestly, I haven't. I defer to what Derek says.
Okay. I wonder, what is the status at this point of those sanctions, Bob? Are they still in play, or does the president have the power to unilaterally set them aside?
Well, depends on which sanctions you're talking about. The U.S. has already imposed sanctions on China of a couple of billion dollars for their steel and aluminum exports to the U.S. What's at issue now is as much as $150 billion worth of tariffs. They haven't been imposed. The first $50 billion of it is gone through most of the kind of administrative proceeding. The second $100 billion has kind of been lost in the ether. He can go through with it, unlikely, frankly, at this point, or he can set them aside. I mean, it's at his discretion.
Let's hear from Elaine in Schenectady.
The whole issue of Trump's investments in, Asia, and it was mentioned Indonesia, it brings up, in the public's mind that he really should have divested fully, because it creates the appearance that he is favoring his own investments over things like national security and his relationship with China. He should have divested from these interests.
That's a very interesting point, and perhaps a fair point, Derek Scissors. The president is in the unusual situation of having a vast and complicated portfolio of businesses. Who's to say where the potential conflicts might be? He hasn't released his tax returns. We've had a new financial disclosure this week, but still lots and lots of questions. Shouldn't we know more in order to rule out the possibility of an ulterior motive?
I think I agree with that. If you're going to run for president, you don't get to keep your business or, frankly, your personal life just the way it was without public scrutiny. So even though I don't think there's anything to the criticism of the Indonesia transaction, I do think the caller is right that we would be in a better position judging the president's motives with a surprise event like this tweet on Sunday if we knew that there wasn't anything going on, an ongoing business with him or his family. Now, they have the right to continue their business, but it's not a good look. I do think it raises questions. And I think when you run for president, you have to make some sacrifices. President Trump didn't want to sacrifice this, and I think it was a mistake.
In the press briefing on Monday, the White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Rod Shaw defended the president's statements on this ZTE deal. Let's hear what he had to say.
He's introduced and proposed over, or rather up to, $150 billion of tariffs on China for intellectual property theft, dumping, and a range of inimical Chinese economic actions. So he's been tough, and he's confronted them. But on this issue specifically, he's asked the Secretary of Commerce to take a look at it.
That's Rod Shaw at the White House podium there. Where would you like to see this headed, Derek Scissors? I mean, you're coming at this from the American Enterprise Institute. I suppose you would like to see the White House maintain these sanctions regardless of whatever the trade deal is.
Yeah, I would like to put U.S. law first. When you're dealing with China, which is not a rule of law country, you have a lot of companies which will break the law because they are used to getting away with it. We need to make sure that does not happen. That should be the priority in dealing with ZTE and other Chinese companies. Beyond that, the president's really focused on the trade deficit, which I don't think is the right focus. But everything, below U.S. law is secondary. I don't have a problem. Bob mentioned earlier that the $100 billion sanctions hasn't appeared. I don't have a problem with that. That can be put on the table. Let's see what we can get in bargaining with China. But what we don't do is bend U.S. law for the sake of a trade deal.
Bob Davis, do you think this is a tempest in a teapot or something more serious?
No, it's pretty serious. I mean, the... ZTE is supposed to be separate from the trade deal. The White House can say all it wants that the president's been tough on China. Frankly, we'll see. There's talks this week, and we'll see how tough he really is. But ZTE is just separate. I mean, violating the sanctions on Iran and North Korea should have nothing, essentially, to do with whether the U.S. cracks down on intellectual property issues regarding China. They're just separate.
That's Bob Davis, senior editor at The Wall Street Journal, who covers economic issues. Thank you so much for your time today. Also, Derek Scissors, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amato, Stefano Kotsonis, Allison Poli, Catherine Proctor, Tanya Rally, and James Ross. The executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Wright, and this is On Point.